This tax season is the first under a new federal tax cut. We've had some tips on how to get everything ready if you haven't yet filed. The deadline is April 15th. Plus, we hear about the independent film series Real Midwest, which showcases documentaries, features, and shorts from Illinois and our neighbors. And the Rusty Patch Bumblebee is in trouble. It's gotten so bad for this endangered species that the NRDC is suing the federal government.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up later this hour, we'll talk about a film project that's highlighting films made and set in the Midwest. And we'll hear about an endangered bee that's making its way to federal court. But first, tax day, April 15th, is right around the corner. This time around, you might notice a few changes. For one thing, it's the first tax season when the federal tax cut, passed late in 2017, will actually take effect. And of course, for 35 days, starting in December and going well into January, IRS employees worked without pay during the government shutdown. Back in February, shortly after that shutdown, and just before the government avoided another one, we spoke with a couple of Illinois tax experts who gave us their tips for this time of year. Carmi Gregory has more than 45 years of tax experience. She's a tax advisor with H&R Block in Sycamore and DeKalb County. Drake Zimmerman is principal for First Allied Securities in Normal. Carmi, Drake, welcome to the 21st. Good morning.
Good morning.
Carmi, let's start with you. When we're thinking about filing this time around, how big of a change are this year's taxes compared to previous years?
I think one of the biggest changes is the look. People that are used to using their prior year as sort of a template for their current year, it doesn't look the same at all. So I think that's one of the biggest changes for a lot of the do-it-yourselfers. In terms of the actual taxes themselves, with the reduction in the tax rates, with the loss of the dependent, everybody's looking to say, hey, where do I put my kid? Well, you don't put your kid. They still account for it, and the kids still count for the child tax credits. They still count for babysitting. They still count for, perhaps if they're over 17, for the family credit. They still count for the education credits, but they don't physically show up on that front page like you're used to seeing them. Also, the thing that we're finding is a lot of people who in the past have gotten $4,000 or $5,000 or $6,000 as a refund may not be getting that much this year because they were getting it in their paychecks as each paycheck came out during the year. So those are some of the biggest changes that hit people automatically.
Yeah, those are some big ones right up front. Drake, I wonder how time-consuming it was to get yourself and everyone else in your office up to speed on how different tax law is this year.
Oh, it was very time-consuming. Back at the end of 17, we went through everybody's return to see what kind of planning we had to do in 17 preparing for 18. And then for 18, with all the changes, there seemed to be a change again and again and again that we would discover. So we spent a lot of time going through everybody's itemized deductions, everybody's income, and the type of income. Was it capital gains? Was it ordinary income? What were they giving was really important, and how much they give, because until you give a particular level, you don't get any deductions. But once you hit that level, you get all of your deductions are very good. We do a lot of charitable planning. I'm a chartered advisor in philanthropy, like a CPA, only a CAP, and so we do a lot of charitable planning.
I want to get to some of those details about charitable planning second with you, Drake. But, Carmi, can I ask you about the government shutdown and if you saw ripple effects in your work, whether that was with communicating with the IRS or with clients who may have been affected?
There was a great deal of it because anybody that had items pending with the IRS, even if it was in collections was working at about 50% where they normally would work. And it meant longer times hanging on the phone if that was what you were trying to connect with.
And so, collections meaning people who owe the IRS money or the reverse?
People who owed the IRS and they were trying to work out a payment plan with
them. I see.
It could still be done, but it was taking much longer to get all of that done. people that had IRS letters or they were in audit, everything was just sort of suspended for that 35, 38 days. Talking with an agent last Thursday, and I said to her, I said, do you anticipate the next shutdown? She said, we are planning for it. We're not going to get caught like we were last time. So even many of them in the service center are indicating that they're planning for another shutdown, but they're doing business as usual, and they're trying to get caught up on the myriad amounts of correspondences that had come in while they were shut down.
Drake, what advice do you have for us, the taxpayer, on our end in terms of how we should be prepared in case there is another government shutdown?
Patience and planning. The IRS people have been cut in staff even before this. They then get hit with a new tax law, and then on top of that, they get shut down. So please be very warm and respectful, and these people are trying to do a very difficult job to begin with and then had the shutdown on top of that. So please be kind to all, be kind to your IRS agent.
That's a good reminder, Drake. Carmi, can I ask also, this is a good time to remind everyone, this time of year, there's also a danger of fraud and scams. I think it kind of goes up a little bit. It's a good reminder, Drake said he was talking about correspondence. The IRS never calls or emails anyone, right, Carmi?
That's quite correct. Unless you have already an ongoing issue where you have given permission to them to talk to you, they will not call you. They send everything by correspondence. If it gets to a certain stage, it then becomes certified letters. They will not just arbitrarily make that phone call, nor will they just arbitrarily come out and knock on your door unless there's been a whole history of items along the way, a whole history of correspondences being ignored, not responded to properly, not timely responded and answered on. And that includes Social Security and the state of Illinois likewise. Now many of the scammers are beginning to call, and they're no longer identifying themselves as Internal Revenue Service. They're beginning to identify themselves as being with Social Security or with the state of Illinois or whatever state might be involved, trying to work around this whole system of, well, people are now getting smart, and they're not going to respond if we say Internal Revenue Service.
So just a reminder. Go ahead, Drake.
Correct. The Federal Trade Commission has stamped on those scams again and again, but it's like you stamp on one and five more splash out. And it is the other agencies that are getting, are having their names dragged into the mud, the Social Security and the others.
And to that point, Drake, also about Social Security, if you're social, it's always better to file earlier rather than later. And that's also in case of fraud or if your Social Security number has been stolen, right?
Absolutely.
Generally, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Carmi, so let's go to some of these changes in the tax law. You mentioned some of them in the beginning. I wonder if we can get to some specifics here. You talked about, first of all, and I think this is an important one for people who are used to claiming dependents. What does that look like on the form now? What information do people need to know about that?
Well, people would still, depending upon the program they're using, and of course if it's with a commercial preparer such as H&R Block, they would also have our programs automatically. We put the children's names in, birth dates and all of this so that it carries through our program. If they're doing it themselves, then they need to be very careful that if they're doing like a babysitting form, that the right child's name, identification, birth date, and all is properly placed in there. If they're doing an education form, that they make sure they get the correct child's information put into there so that it follows on through with what they have going on in their return. If they're claiming someone who is over the age of 17, that they have identified that person so they get the family credit. That's $500 per person that's coming along if they qualify for it. Making sure that they have properly identified by name and the full name, Social Security number, and birth date, so when it follows through the Internal Revenue Service, that it can easily be identified. A lot of mismatches between names and Social Security numbers are still happening. A few minutes ago, Drake mentioned the itemized deductions when he was talking. That's another issue that we've had clients that for years have been able to write off employee business expenses, their mileages. If they were a truck driver, a W-2 truck driver, their over-the-road per diems for meals. If they were a teacher, their classroom supplies. If they were an auto mechanic and they were building their box of tools, those costs of those tools. All of that has gotten union dues.
So that's all changed now?
How is it? No longer are deductible by an employee.
Okay. None of those qualify anymore, Carmi.
Correct.
And Drake, the standard deduction has also gone up, right? Can you explain a little bit more about that?
Every individual starts now with a higher standard deduction, which is $12,000. If you are above the age of 65, at or above 65, it's slightly higher. So a $12,000 single individual deduction would be $13,600. If you're married filing jointly, the $24,000 and both are 65 or older goes to $26,600. What that means and what that translates into is that you have to have more itemizable deductions, the medical, the charitable, the mortgage interest, the state and local taxes that have to get to and beyond those levels.
That threshold.
Before they are deductible.
So theoretically, it sounds like the changes, like Carmi, everything you were talking about, whether it would be meals or things that people would claim as expenses, theoretically, some of that should get folded into this deduction threshold rate rising, correct?
Correct. That's one of the things they were hoping to reduce the need for itemized deductions by doubling the standard deduction. And it has helped a bit. But it's also cut out an awful lot of individuals. For example, many of them would have gone over that 12 or 18 or 24 amount if they could itemize. And the other thing was the reduction on the state and local taxes. Even now, people who have been able to itemize because they had fairly high real estate taxes or fairly high withholdings or the combination of the two, that has a restriction of no more than $10,000 for all of their taxes. That's hurt a lot of people.
Yes.
With Drake being involved in the charitable group, that is still in effect. There was a lot of people who during the year thought they couldn't itemize anymore because they couldn't take off their charitable. But someone who is extremely philanthropic will still be able to write those charities off. If they've got $40,000 in charitable donations, they can still write them off. They'll still go over their 12 or 18 or 24 amount.
Right. So what's the threshold then, Drake, when we're thinking about charitable as well? Is it the same threshold?
You group it together with the other itemizable deductions, so medical plus mortgage plus charitable and your state and local taxes. When you put those all together for an individual single, do you pass $12,000? Well, if you're making, say, $100,000 in wages, you pay about $5,000 in state taxes. If you have a house that has property taxes of $5,000, you now have 5 plus 5. You've hit the limit on your state and local taxes. So if you're a single person, you only have to get $2,000 more of charitable deductions before you can deduct it.
I see.
So what you do with what you have the most control over the charitable deductions. And so what we've been doing is having people look at their charitable deductions, group them. So if you give to your faith organization, you might do two.
Or your local public radio station.
Or your local public radio. For full disclosure, I'm the longest running corporate donor for local WGLT.
Oh, well, thank you. On behalf of WGLT, sure.
Sure, for the last 35 years.
Can I ask you, Drake, I wonder how much things have changed in 35 years in terms of record keeping. And I was laughing during the Super Bowl commercial last night for Expensify. I don't know if you guys saw that, but it was basically the rap. It was 2 Chainz talking about how he has an app to take charge of his expenses. And I wanted to ask you guys, we have a couple more minutes here just as we wrap up, just to ask about best practices going forward for people in terms of keeping track of their finances, keeping track of records. Do you have an opinion, Drake, first of all, on paper or electronic, which one's best?
Whatever works for you. We have a lot of people who will have a series of envelopes or paper bags even or boxes that we have them throw their bills into over the course of the year or a drawer. Others will keep it electronically. It sort of depends on which part of the millennium, which millennium you were born in. And the idea is keep records. If you have good records, there's no fear for an audit unless you're doing something nefarious or the fear of an audit. You get an audit letter and you say, oh, I have all those receipts. Let me just copy them and send them. Whether you have them electronically or in paper, you've got it there. People get this letter from the IRS. Usually audits are paper audits. They send you a letter and they say, you owe this. Then you say, oh, well, actually, you're asking about this or this, my charitable deductions. I've got receipts for all those and copies of things. I'll just send those all in and you're fine. So keep good paperwork. However you keep them is the key advice.
Harmy, what advice do you have for people who are not good at keeping good paperwork?
Start. What I do find, and I will have to rubber stamp what Drake just said, although I do lean more towards the paper rather than the electronic, the reason being is that after 18 to 24 months, some of those electronics just automatically disappear, and then they don't have that documentation. For example, if they have tollway expenses, you can pull down your tollway expenses for up to, I believe it's 18 months, and then after that you can't go back further. Many of these audits would take place longer than 18 months later. If somebody is keeping their records and you can't use it this year, don't throw it out, though. Keep it because there's a chance there's going to be a retroactive ruling, such as we had last year on February 8th. There was a five major items were retroactively reinstated for the year 17. That meant amended returns if you'd already filed to be able to use those. And we always are looking at that possibility. Keep them at least 1 year before you toss them out, just in case there's going to be a retroactive.
3 to 5 years would be better because sometimes they do, things will carry
forward. Rubber stamp that also.
This year is a good year to start keeping records if you haven't already. That was Carmi Gregory. She's a tax advisor with H&R Block in Sycamore. We also spoke with Drake Zimmerman, who's principal for First Allied Securities in Normal. Coming up after the break, we're revisiting our conversation about the film series Real Midwest, which includes documentaries, shorts, and features from Illinois and Midwest directors. That's after the break. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for listening to this Encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. When it comes to the movie industry, we often think of the East and West Coast as the epicenters of talent. But this year, a new independent film series, Real Midwest, that's R-E-E-L, set out to show that's nothing but a myth by highlighting documentaries, features, and short films from Illinois and its neighbors. Back in January, the series kicked off with Inquiring Nuns, the first theatrical release by Kurtemquin Films. Here's a clip.
We're working a little experiment with film and asking questions and then kind of just talking on the street. Would you like to be a part of it?
Sure, why not?
First question's easy. Are you happy?
Groovy.
That's a bit of Inquiring Nuns, which launched the film series Real Midwest back in January. When it first launched, we sat down with Moss Bresnahan to learn more about it. He's the president and CEO of Illinois Public Media, which produces The 21st and is home to WILL Radio and TV. And he's one of the people who brought Real Midwest to our small screen. We started by asking him what the goal of this series was.
Well, I love independent films, and as you mentioned, not all great documentaries come from New York or L.A. The Midwest has a thriving independent film community. In Chicago, but really throughout the Midwest. And independent films line up so well with the mission of public broadcasting. The producers are taking creative risks. They're out there presenting diverse points of view, taking on complex subjects that you don't see always in the mainstream media. And these are films that really deserve to be seen. And so I think it's part of public broadcasting's mission to bring them to our audience.
So let's play a couple clips of them. And let's start with Shine Man, which is one of the films that is included in this Real Midwest series. Let's hear a clip of it.
There's always a connection that happens between that human being working on your shoes and that human being needing that shine. There's an unspoken kind of a character that happens there. There's something that does occur, and whether that person, you know, says, hey, thank you very much, or leaves a big tip or whatever, and I know their life's not changed, but there is a human connection that happens, a very intimate connection that happens between a man shining your shoes and you sitting there having your shoes shined.
A Shine Man, part of the Real Midwest film series that we're talking about now with Moss Bresnahan, who's the president and CEO of Illinois Public Media. Moss, I wonder, that film, others, how did you pick these?
Well, we had dozens of submissions. That one came to us from Kartemkin Films as part of their Voice for Voices and Documentary program, a great mentorship program that they offer for young filmmakers of color. And that was one of three films for Diverse Voices. They really stood out for their just great character development. And another one of those is a film by Bing Liu, now well-known because of Minding the Gap, shortlisted for Academy Awards. What we did is we really gathered a collection of program directors from around the Midwest, from public TV stations, and went through the films and picked them for the diversity of the filmmakers, the films. It's really an eclectic mix. Some are films that have just been finished. Others, as you mentioned, Inquiring Nuns, 50 years old, but an amazing...
Yeah, you can hear that from the voices of Groovy.
I mean, it was a charming film. You know, watching that film was like opening a time capsule. It's just a fascinating look at Chicago in 1967. And the grainy black and white footage is riveting, and it has a film score by Philip Glass, which is amazing.
Wow.
And so it's really, the first season is a very eclectic mix of films, and I think that's what makes it so much fun.
We're talking about the Real Midwest series. Moss Bresnahan is here with us. He's the president and CEO of Illinois Public Media. And I wanted to welcome two of the filmmakers who are also participating in Real Midwest. David Rocchio is one of the producers of The Gun Shop. He's on the line from Vermont. Alan Parsa is a Chicago documentarian by the way of the Behind the Way to Andina. David, Arlen, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Thank you. Hey, Nyla. Thanks for having us.
David, let's start with you. The gun shop that's set for the setting for your film is actually in Battle Creek, Michigan. It's called Freedom Firearms. What was the goal with setting up your cameras in one particular gun shop?
Well, this show came from an idea I had. I live in Vermont. I feel bad because I'm not a Midwesterner, but I'm really happy to be.
We'll give you honorary status, David.
Thanks very much. Vermont is as Midwestern as you can get this side of the Mississippi, so... My vision was to create a documentary about a gun shop around here just to show the humanity of the people in the shop and let the story of guns tell itself. And then for circuitous reasons, I ended up talking to James Rogan, who took the lead on the project. He's a British documentarian, and he pitched me on the idea of selling it to Channel 4 because he thought it would be fascinating for UK audiences to look through the window into an American gun shop. And I love the idea of having a British team involved because they don't come to it with any biases. And then Channel 4 pushed us really hard to go urban, and we told them we wanted to be in a market that had cross sections of people, and it was not geared towards any one side of the discussion. And so we settled on the Middle West and Midwest, and we worked really hard to find a shop that trusted us. And Joel at Freedom Firearms fit the bill. The director of the documentary is named John Douglas. He's a British filmmaker and is a master of fixed-rig cameras. So we set up in the gun shop for 12 days and filmed everything. And it was a pretty interesting experience.
Let's play. We've got a little clip of it. Let's take a listen.
A gun is a machine. It is a machine that's efficient at doing its job, which unfortunately makes these mass shootings and whatnot more capable, but it is still a machine. The most unhelpful argument out there is take away all the guns, because that instantly makes the other side, and even the moderates who own weapons, it makes them just locked down. We have to accept that we have a problem and come together and work on a solution together without all the hate and rhetoric.
David, what can you tell us about that particular figure in the film?
Well, I don't want to get into the narrative arc of the story because I think that's something that people will discover when they watch it. But it was really profound for us. So what we did, we set up in the gun shop and we agreed we could film everything. We had to get releases, obviously, and then any stories we wanted to follow that came up in the shop, we could follow. And so this is a story that developed from a conversation within the gun shop. So it describes something that happened in the community. My vision for the show is to create real dialogue about guns in America. And the way you do that in the first instance is by listening. So it really is just a window on the culture of the shop. And the man who you just heard speaking, he was very articulate in a very difficult circumstance. And I didn't know what he would say when he was asked about what should be done about guns given the circumstances he was in. And I thought it was a really thoughtful answer, and it fits with our thesis that as we make a film about all the different interest groups on the issues of guns, we'll find more common ground than people think, and it'll be interesting to see if there really is an us and them on this issue as opposed to just us.
That's David Rocchio. He's one of the producers of The Gun Shop. He's the founder of Stowe Story Labs. And The Gun Shop is part of this Real Midwest film series that we have been talking about. Arlen Parsa is another on a complete, a very different topic. His film is called The Way to Andina. Arlen, so this focuses on the Colombian composer Eustacio Rosales, who just happens to be your great-grandfather. And before you tell us a little bit about it, I just wanted to play a little clip of this because to give us the audience a sense of the journey that they go on as you learn about your family's rich musical history.
When I think opera, I think like, ugh. Opera music feels like some kind of dinosaur that forgot to go extinct. It's not my favorite.
Should you be trying to resurrect this thing that maybe belongs dead?
What if we go to all this trouble, you know, hire a bunch of musicians and stuff and get a theater, and then it turns out that this music sucks? Maybe that's why it was never performed. We have no idea.
Arlen, how did this process begin for you?
Well, it was a wild adventure. Basically, my aunt called me up on the phone and she said, listen, I have something in my basement that I've been meaning to show you. And I went over to her place and we found these boxes in her basement and they were chock full of this antique handwritten sheet music. You know, it's funny, Moss talks about Inquiring Nuns being this time capsule from Chicago 50 years ago. This was a time capsule from Chicago 100 years ago. We had all this antique handwritten sheet music written by Eustacio Rosales, who is my great-grandfather. He was a groundbreaking Hispanic composer here in Chicago, and he wrote all this music, and he started getting some fame and acclaim, and then all of a sudden he died one day, and it was sort of in the middle of the Great Depression, and his music went in a box, and it stayed in that box for almost 100 years. And so for me as a young person, seeing this music and not knowing the first thing about classical music or opera, I wanted to solve that mystery and figure out what did this music sound like and kind of fill in this gaping hole in my family tree.
And this also won Best Documentary at the Chicago Latino Film Festival. I wonder what you think this story tells us also. It's another Midwestern story.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. This is absolutely a Midwestern story, but it has its roots down in Colombia because my great-grandfather, Eustacio, he was an immigrant. He came from Bogota, Colombia in the early 20th century. And so part of, you know, his music-making career in the United States, in Chicago and other parts of the Midwest, was blending different types of music. He had kind of his own influences from back home down south, but he sort of melded these with other influences that he came across in Chicago. And the opera that we end up performing in the film, his long-lost work, it kind of has these different influences, and it's really interesting and fun to listen to.
How did it change the way you think about your family, Arlen?
For me, it was a really emotional experience because this is a person who I never met, right? He died 80 years before we started this project. And so it was kind of like reconnecting with your past in a way and understanding a little bit more about kind of where you come from, where I came from, and understanding more about, you know, the world that I live in. I think for me, it's so important to be able to, you know, connect with that past. When we think about today and we think about people arguing over immigration and things like that, for a lot of Americans, immigration, although we might be descended from someone who came here from somewhere else, it's kind of this detached thing. And so to be able to actually put hands on something that he wrote, you know, this ink on the page, it kind of made me connect with that in a way that was new and fresh.
That's Arlen Parsa, who's based in Chicago, and we've been talking about The Way to Andina. David Recchio has been with us as well. He's one of the producers of The Gun Shop. This is all part of the Real Midwest independent film series. David, Arlen, I wanted to just ask both of you guys about what it's like to be producing films and working in this industry and not be in New York or L.A. Arlen, you're in Chicago. David, you're based in Vermont, although this film that we've been talking about is set in Michigan. Do you think that there are advantages to not being on the coasts?
I'll go first and say no. I think it's much harder to be distal, but I think it's much more interesting to find work that maybe you don't get pushed into doing because of what the market's dictating. And our experience with this show has been really interesting because it's sold very, very well overseas, but it's taken a long time to find someone willing to take it on in the U.S. because it doesn't take a typical approach to the issue of guns in America.
Right, because it's a really nuanced, it's sort of, I think, something that people on both sides of the issue will both find. It doesn't take a specific position. Arlen, what about you and being a Chicago-based filmmaker?
Chicago, obviously, it's a little bit of a smaller community than the filmmaking communities in, you know, on the coast, New York and L.A., but there can be some advantages to that. I think some of the cost, production costs may be a little bit lower. And the community is a little bit more tight-knit. You know more people. But I'll tell you the truth. You know, David and I both work in nonfiction and documentary, and we know that there's stories to be told all over the country, all over the world. And I think geography doesn't need to be a restricting factor in the same way that maybe it was many years ago.
This is really one of the goals of a program like Real Midwest, too, to bring together the film community in the region and to try and support it and to encourage filmmaking and young filmmakers.
And that's Moss Bresnahan, who is with Illinois Public Media, the CEO who's launched this independent film series, Real Midwest, along with Kartemquin Films in Chicago. Moss, what are you hoping viewers take away from this?
Well, I think Real Midwest fits right in with the tradition of public media and our origins and our mission. I mean, we have the national series like POV and Independent Lens. I think Real Midwest complements those series really well. And, you know, I love the fact that it's bringing to air films that people otherwise might not have seen. Winners of film festivals and awards and recognition around the world. But, you know, the ability to bring it to local audiences is something that I think is really important and at the heart of what we do at Illinois Public Media.
That's Moss Bresnahan, CEO of Illinois Public Media. I want to thank David Recchio, founder of Stowe Story Labs and a producer behind The Gun Shop. Alan Parsa is based in Chicago. His film is The Way to Andina. All of these are on Real Midwest, this film series we've been talking about. We'll have more information about this at our website at 21stshow.org if you're interested in these films. Guys, all of you, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks
so much. Very
much.
Thanks for listening to a special encore edition of The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. You've probably heard lots of news stories about the decline in population here in Illinois, and I'm not just talking about people. Important animal species like the rusty patch bumblebee are also struggling in numbers, so much so that the Natural Resources Defense Council is taking the federal government to court. They filed a lawsuit back in January, accusing the Interior Department and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services of violating parts of the Endangered Species Act, which could have preserved habitats that the bees depend on. The case is still ongoing, and after a 30-day extension, the next filing for the government is now due at the end of this month. Alexandra Harmon Threet is a professor at U of I's Department of Entomology, and from the NRDC's Nature Program in Chicago, legal director Rebecca Riley is with us. I spoke with them back in January. Both of you, welcome to The 21st.
Thanks, Nyla, for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Alex, before we talk about the lawsuit, can you tell us a little bit more about the rusty patched bumblebee? This is different from honeybees, for example.
Yes. So most people kind of forget that we have bees other than honeybees. But when you think back about it, you'll realize how many bees you see in the environment, particularly bumblebees. The rusty patch is actually a pretty large bumblebee. It's really beautiful. It has this rusty colored semicircle kind of on one of its color patches that's outlined in yellow. So it's pretty distinctive looking. It's very large, too.
And then when we think about bees, we think about them creating honey. But what about their role also in bees like the rusty patch bumblebee as a pollinator?
Yeah, so I'd like to remind people that there are over 20,000 species of bees. So the rusty patch is just one of them. And most of those bees don't make honey. Honeybees do that, and we learn a lot about that in schools. But almost none of the other bees actually make any honey at all. They maybe have very bumblebees do keep very small amounts of nectar kind of in pots in their hives, but they don't actually keep honey or make honey that we would really particularly want to eat.
Mm-hmm.
But they're really important for pollination, right? And pollination is a really critical service that gives us all of these bright and beautiful things in our environment and actually supports life on our planet as we know it. You know, lots of things depend on plants and the seeds that plants produce. And if those seeds don't get pollinated well, then we don't have those seeds. We don't have those fruits to eat. And that's going to be a pretty dismal life for us.
Mm. Rebecca Riley is with us from the NRDC. I mentioned a lawsuit that organization has filed against the Interior Department and U.S. Fish and Wildlife. What is the Endangered Species Act supposed to be doing when it comes to supporting life like bumblebees, Rebecca?
So the Endangered Species Act protects species that are on the brink of extinction. And the rusty patch bumblebee is one of those species. In just the last 20 years, we've lost about 90% of the population, which is a really, really quick decline for a species. Now, this is actually our third lawsuit that we've filed about the rusty patch bumblebee. The first two were to get it put on the endangered species list. And so now that it's protected, what the law is supposed to also do is protect something called critical habitat. And these are special habitat areas that the law gives a higher level of protection to so that we can help recover the species and bring it back to a healthy population level.
And according to your lawsuit, what are you all alleging the federal government has failed to do?
So the law very clearly requires the government to do what's called designate critical habitat. And they do that by identifying certain geographic areas where a species lives and where perhaps it could live in the future that deserve this higher level of protection. And in this case, the Fish and Wildlife Service hasn't even started to carry out that process. So what you would ordinarily see is a proposed rule and then a final rule designating critical habitat, and we haven't even seen a proposed rule yet. So we filed this lawsuit to force the Fish and Wildlife Service to carry out its responsibilities under the law and to protect these special habitat areas for the rusty patch bumblebee, which will also protect habitat for other species, including bees and other insects and wildlife.
And Rebecca, to be clear, this law was supposed to have been implemented last January, right? It's been an entire year?
That's right. So the way that the Endangered Species Act works is when a species is listed as threatened or endangered, it's supposed to get critical habitat protection right away. But the law contains a little bit of an exception where they can extend that for 1 year. So that's what the Fish and Wildlife Service did here. When they listed the bee, they didn't designate critical habitat, and they did that 1 year extension. But now we're far past when they should have designated critical habitat. And like I said, we haven't even seen a proposed rule yet. And so that's why we thought this lawsuit was really the only way to make sure we get the protections the bee needs.
Alex, Rebecca mentioned the huge decline. So we're looking at almost a 90% decline in the rusty patch bumblebee population over the last two decades. This used to be pretty common, not just across the Midwest, the rusty patch bumblebee, but also the Northeast, right?
Yes, it used to be a fairly common bumblebee, and actually some colleagues of mine said they used to see them in their yards.
And now, how important is a loss? How much do we attribute the decline to a loss of habitat? What other factors are also involved here?
There seem to be a lot of kind of interactive factors that are contributing to the declines of this bumblebee and lots of other species. Habitat loss is one major one, but then there's also pesticides. There's disease. There seems to be a lot of an increase in disease prevalence for these species as well. And then climate change, which is a major stressor that can basically exacerbate some of these other effects. Like if your body is constantly stressed, obviously you if you get a pathogen, it's harder to fight them off, and particularly if that's interacting with this loss of habitat and loss of forage for the bees, then they don't have any of the resources that they need to be able to fight off these pathogens.
So let's go through a couple of those. How important is having habitat in terms of a space for them, and how has that changed over the past 20 years?
So the habitat has certainly, there hasn't been that much of an increase in agriculture in the last 20 years, but there has been a change and an increase in the pesticides and herbicides that are used in those habitats, and that can have these, or an adjacent agricultural habitat, and that can have some negative effects on the pollinator populations. And then the disease, obviously, is something that can spread really rapidly. And when you have less habitat available, then the bees are interacting more frequently, and that actually can spread pathogens more rapidly. So mm-hmm. you actually can concentrate pathogens just by having less habitat. So these things, all, none of them individually is affecting the bee, but they are kind of working synergistically to really negatively affect their population sizes.
And then when we think about climate change, how is that affecting the bee population, especially across the Midwest, for the rusty patch bumblebee in particular? You said in the beginning they're kind of bigger bees?
Yeah, so large bees, they are in some ways more sensitive to increases in climate. Bumblebees in particular tend to be more diverse and larger in colder climate. So they, like in mountains and places like that, they seem to usually see more species of bumblebees. And so as the climate changes, that creates a lot of stress on their bodies because they're just not really adapted to really warm and warm temperatures. And so that can actually be really bad for them. They also need a long growing season in order to be able to make more queens for the future generations. And so if the temperature is highly variable like it is now, that can actually be really hard for them in terms of making it through a full colony cycle to have these reproductives.
So they don't even have a full population, whole season to fully repopulate is what you're saying?
Yeah, so they need the full season. And if the weather is really variable, like we've seen in the last few years, where it can be really cold or it can warm up really in the spring and then get really cold again, those kinds of things can hit those guys really hard.
And so where across Illinois are we seeing populations now? You said they're pretty hard to find.
Yeah, so they anything pretty much north of Springfield is considered possible habitat for them. There is right now my lab is doing some work to try and look for these species in some of the central areas because we have populations of them kind of north near Kankakee and then some kind of south near Bloomington and Springfield. But then there seems to be a band where we haven't seen them in many years. And so we're trying to do some more looking for this bee to try and see where the population extends. Do they go into any further south in Illinois, or are they mostly restricted to the northern parts, kind of north of Chicago?
That's Alex Harmon-Threet with U of I's Department of Entomology talking about the work she's doing and helping us understand a little bit more about the decline of the rusty patch bumblebee population. Rebecca Riley with the NRDC, this lawsuit that you have filed against the federal government, what would be an ideal outcome?
What typically happens in these cases is we get a hard court-ordered deadline for the Fish and Wildlife Service to complete this work. So that means they will sit down with us and we'll talk about what's reasonable based on their workload and, you know, come to an agreement about finishing this critical habitat designation.
Alex, just as we wrap up here, I wonder if there are people who are listening who think these bees don't even make honey. Why do we care whether or not they exist?
Yeah, the same reason we should care about all kinds of diversity in our society. It provides us with a colorful and vibrant life, right? If we have pollinators that are pollinating both the crops that we need pollinated, but also just the flowers that we need pollinated, that allows us to live in this very colorful world of with flowers that are blooming and birds that are feeding on those seeds that are produced by those flowers and insects that are chirping and making other noises and providing us with other services like decomposition that we really need. We have to have a diverse planet in order to be able to survive here. And so they contribute, you know, they're just one piece that contributes significantly to this, to stabilizing our ecosystems.
That's Alex Harmon Threet, who teaches in the Department of Entomology at the University of Illinois. Rebecca Riley was also with us, the legal director of NRDC's Nature Program in Chicago. It's Election Day in cities all over Illinois today, and in Chicago, no matter who wins, the city will have its first female African-American mayor. Tomorrow, Brian Moline will bring you live results and analysis from all across the state, and we'll hear about an exhibit that's ongoing right now at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum in Springfield. It's actually Lawrence Schiller's iconic photos of President Kennedy's life. We're out of time for today. If you follow us on Twitter, our handle is 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. We'll try to keep in track on all this election news this evening, so if you want to follow us for that. On our Facebook page, if you search for the 21st to like us, you can comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All of those links and every other way to contact us. If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us at social media, all you have to remember is our website. It's 21stshow.org. We've also got all of our past shows there, but if you podcast, you can also get our shows on Spotify, iTunes, Android, most places you get your podcasts. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio, who's our senior producer. Bobby McSwine is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, And I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.